glances at her, alarmed.
Throne, though. I don't know, do I?
She remembers what she saw in the Astropath's tower.
Get us there, quick.
She looks back, to where the lights of the command complex are blinking through the dust and wind.
It all looks solid enough. A scatter of low-rise HAB compounds set about the scaffolds of the main comm tower.
The big drop sites are back east, the hangars for the crawlers a few hundred meters away beyond the wind wall. Everything is chipped and blustered, lost in a permanent fog of rad glow and storm clutter. She turns back. The crawler's arc lights flash across a sloped militarum-grade blast wall and a toothed compound gate. Flood lumens have been hoisted up to the parapet level, and for the first time ever, she catches sight of troops in environment suits patrolling up there.
See that?
Makkard says, nudging the crawler inside as the gates cantilever open. She says nothing. She is beginning to feel more than a little sick. The crawler makes its way to the far side of the compound before shuddering to a halt. Both of them put masks on and tighten their collars. Then the doors push open. The cab immediately fills with flying chaff, and they battle their way down to ground level. Dantine is waiting for them, flanked by a few of his staff officers, all wrapped up in layers of environment swaddling. Dantine comes up to Bhattacharya and salutes.
"Tried to get you on the comm!"
he shouts over the wind's howl.
"All down!" Bhattacharya shouts back. "Can we get inside?"
"Agreed. There's something you should see."
"Am I going to like it?"
Dantine doesn't look like he's smiling.
"Just come inside, Administrator," he shouts grimly.
Captain Dantine is a better man than he has any right to be. Bhattacharya does not know the full story, but he must have fallen foul of someone in authority somewhere, and if there were any justice, he'd be serving in an Astra Militarum regiment with decent troops under his command. It is unclear how he has ended up on Najan. It seems unlikely he volunteered for the posting. For all that, he has taken to the tasking well. His predecessor was a drunk and a brute, killed in a brawl involving several dozen of his own men. Since Dantine came to replace him, things have calmed down in the barracks. Amasek flows a little less freely, and the uniforms are put on straight. Dantine does not normally order patrols on the battlements. Spending more than an hour or so in the open risks eroding the limited amount of good equipment they possess. So, like most of Najan's human population, the soldiers are mostly kept confined to quarters, or drilled in covered yards. Dantine takes them down into the garrison's lower levels. As they walk, Bhattacharya hears sounds of further activity taking place within the base. Clunks and thuds of heavy equipment being moved. Makkard looks uneasy. He finds military types unnerving, despite his physical bulk. They enter a green-walled conference chamber, harshly lit by strip lumens. Four men are seated, but get to their feet as the captain enters. They are in standard fatigues, olive green with flak jackets over a chain-mesh weave. Dantine gestures for them all to sit down again.
"How's it going up at the complex?"
he asks, drawing up a chair and rubbing the grit out of his short cropped hair.
"We're going to have a problem soon," says Bhattacharya. "The workers know something major's happened, just not what. We're not much better off ourselves."
"There's a naval visit due," offers Makkard, sticking to his line.
"I'd have transmitted this earlier,"
says Dantine, reaching for a capsule held by one of his men. "Like everyone else, we've been having problems with our kit, and now the main site comms units are down." Bhattacharya knows what he's holding. It's a message capsule, a secure facsimile of a military transburst.
"You'd better tell me what you know," she says.
Dantine holds up the capsule.
"Sent 6 days ago, in system from a naval corvette. Decoded, finally, last night. It's the one and only communication we got from it, and it wasn't meant for us. It was a full-spectrum broadcast aimed at other vessels in the squadron. The contents were relayed from another ship operating a long way out, and after that, the alpha material bears astropathic markers, so this order came in from a distance. We estimate the original was instantiated more than 2 standard months ago, but that's only a guess."
The captain speaks fast, but without hurrying. Bhattacharya thinks he looks tired, though, and wonders if she looks any better. "There won't be any naval visit, Magister," Dantine says, looking briefly at Makkad. "This is a general order to muster, pulling all assets out of the subsector. Somewhere out there there's a big battle group sucking up all our local units and heading off into the great beyond. They mention Cadia, and they talk about it in the past tense." Past tense. Bhattacharya lets that sink in. Probably just a mistake in transmission. "So there's an action planned," she says. "Maybe. But here's the thing. They were going in cold. This whisper about the Astronomicon, it's not just void chatter. They were crawling through the warp, feeling their way like they were in blindfolds. Never heard them quite so scared about it." She still doesn't believe that. The Astronomicon is just a part of the universe, like starlight or gravity. It can't be gone. "We've got a lot of service ships out there still," she says, "and no news of the conveyors."
"They'll all be dead calmed," says Dantine. "Tell them, Vreed."
He invites one of his men to speak, a red-eyed, preternaturally aged wretch with a sanctioned psycho medallion hanging from a scrawny neck.
"You've seen the lights in the sky,"
Vreed says, and his voice trembles from weakness. He can hardly keep his hands still. It looks like he might expire any second.
"It's not what you think it is. Something's broken. It shouldn't look like that."
Bhattacharya is very tired. She's getting impatient. "Tell it plainly, man," she snaps.
"The warp, Administrator," says Vreed. "Like a local rift effect, but I can't see the end of it. We're on the other side of something, and I can feel it hanging over us. It's like a storm cloud, ready to burst."
"Nonsense," says Makkad.
"What are the effects?" asks Bhattacharya.
"I don't know."
Vreed looks miserable.
"But I can't sleep. It's been a week now. You must have felt it too, surely."
She has. All of them have. That's what's making them scratchy, unable to focus. She sits forward, locking her fingers together. "We're jumping at shadows," she says calmly. "There's been equipment failure. Some loose torque on the voxers. We need to keep it together." She swallows. "There are so few of us, but the job's important. We supply a lot of worlds. I want recommendations." Makkad doesn't have any, and he looks at his hands. Vreed remains haunted, blinking too often. Dantine speaks. "We've been transmitting standard distress calls on Militarum channels. But here's the truth. No one's coming to help us, not if there's a bigger target to defend. So I say we pull the shutters down, disable the servitors, secure the Leviathans, and get my men stationed at all the complex gates. Get your workers armed, too. We've got the equipment. Some of it's still in the issue crates." That will prompt panic, at least at first. The bulk of Bhattacharya's staff wouldn't know which way round to hold a Lasgun. But he's right. She knows he is. "If it comes to it," she says slowly, "if something very bad's going down, there's one more thing." Makkad knows what she means.
"No,"
he says, flatly. "If we need to," she replies firmly. "I was told this when I took the assignment. Protect if you can, destroy if you can't. Nothing for the enemy." Dantine smiles wryly.
"We're not there yet, I hope."
Just as he finishes speaking, there's a hurried rap on the door. A trooper bursts in.
"The complex, sir," he says, looking worried. "Something's happening."
Bhattacharya feels a little bit sicker. Vreed has started to dribble. There is an air of desperation in the room, far out of proportion to the evident danger. She finds herself wanting to scream.
"Sure about that, Captain?" Bhattacharya asks, getting up. "I think you'd better show us where the armory is."
Chapter 7 Dragon comes down in the Morannon, one of Solus's 9 Thunderhawk gunships.
It's a charcoal-black brute, its blunt outline made bulbous and dripping, its surly and decrepit machine spirit gibbering through the internal vox like a trapped animal. Its huge turbines strain against the planet's desiccating winds on the way down, and it sways and lists in the turbulence. Dragon rides it out. He never enjoys the descent. If he were one of Angron's blood-drunk slashers, he'd be whooping now, whipping an already stained blade around in practice for the carnage to come. Dragon is of the Legion, though. He likes his feet on the ground, planted firmly, so he can get a considered swing at his enemy. In the combat-lit crew bay, the rest of them are the same. There's no sound from any of them. Garstag, his Cardane Terminators, a couple of slack-jawed gun servitors. The interior judders and slams. The engines thunder, but they keep their mouths closed. It's odd how a Legion works. Many of the Lords of Silence are barbarians, taken from the gene pool of that mist-wreathed hell planet. A slim majority, though, are not. Most of the non-barbarians were created in the eye from stolen gene seed, implanted by the surgeons into screaming infants wrenched from feral imperial planets, and thus have no connection with the forgotten homeworld. Others, like Dragon, are turncoats and renegades, refugees from distant imperial chapters and warbands. Somehow, though, over time, they all adopt the taciturn habits of Mortarion's own. They stop issuing war cries. They slow down. They let their armor grow thicker, their organs merge, their skin creeps upwards into the filigree of their equipment interfaces. Joining the Death Guard is like sinking into a deep, cold ocean. The substance of it seeps inside, sooner or later, down into every crack and orifice, and you lose the things that once made you what you were. At least, that is his destiny. For Dragon, the process is not yet complete. He still has his skin. He still has three lungs. He can remove his helm, if he wishes, and his tongue is not yet the length of a man's arm. He can feel the rot within, chewing at his bones, making the old tattoos on his chest itch, but it has not yet become endemic. He considers Vorx, whose mind has become soft, and he looks at Slurt, or even Naum, and a part of him still shudders and wishes to put off those things a little longer. He has forgotten where he came from, though. He has no memory of his previous life, only that he was once a servant of the Imperium within a loyalist chapter. The others use that knowledge, if they wish to taunt him, for they know that no one hates the corpse-spawn more than him. You hate what you were, he understands. There is no greater zealot than the convert, he knows. And yet, he has no true faith, not like Vorx or Philemon, just a desire to exert strength, to use the gifts he has been given, to become greater. It is not about the faith for Dragon. It is about vengeance for a life he cannot remember. It is about dominance over a species he has cut all ties with. It is about pride amid a legion that barely understands the notion. He wonders sometimes if he picked the right set of traitors. The Moronon booms into its landing cycle, and greasy warning lumens snap on. Dragon hears the retros surge out, and the direction of momentum shifts. He reaches for a chain loop to steady himself, and the Thunderhawk slams down heavily into the dust of another world. Garstag growls like an animal. The Cardane Master is brutally huge within that confined space, hunched like a coiled dragon in a cave, puffing out condensation from his many helm vents. His warriors grind into action as the ramp creaks open, stomping into a hurricane of dust and organics. Dragon is last out, keeping his talons closed up for now, letting the wind snatch at his bulk, evaporating the gritty surface moisture built up in Solus's humid interior. They have come down in a dust bowl. They are surrounded by nondescript imperial habs, built to a ruthlessly unimaginative template, and shared with every defense station across the galaxy. Lights are blinking in the storm, faint and underpowered. This will be poor killing, he knows already. He crunches his way towards an access hatch. Garstag heads towards another. They break them open with their gauntlets, tearing through the reinforced steel bolts and heaving the plates out. Then Dragon is inside, ducking down low and pushing along a narrow, sectioned corridor. Dust comes in with him, whipping around his knees and piling up against the prefab plasteel wall panels.
He sees the inhabitants, and they spy him. They take one look at him, disbelieving for a moment, and then they run. He lumbers after them, breathing heavily, cracking the floor with cloven treads. He hears screams from a long way off and guesses that's Garstag's work. More gunships are coming down, 4 or 5 of them, and that will be more than enough. He stomps up to what appears to be some kind of command center and smashes the doors in. There are a few hundred baseline humans inside, some armed, all of them incontinent with fear. He gets to work. Las beams flicker over his battle plate, lightly scorching the external patina. He reaches out for the first one, hauls him back, and breaks his back. He goes after another, shattering an eye socket, and has to punch down again to stop the creature's anguished writhing. His killing gauntlet, that mass of angry flesh and metal spines, becomes bloody. He's been cramped up a long time on Solus, and needs to flex his atrophying muscles. Soon he's after a woman, one with an important-looking uniform. She's scrabbling to get away from him, stinking of fear, but she's also got a las pistol and is firing it at him in an impressively determined way. After a few dozen direct hits, that starts to annoy him. He powers towards her, suddenly speeding up, making use of his old Adeptus Astartes shock velocity, which he can still call on if he needs to. He smacks her gun away and lifts her up by the throat.
"Get out!"
she squeaks. Dragan hesitates, briefly amused.
"Get out!"
"Get out!"
It is ridiculous. She is white with terror, flailing at him as if he were vermin under her bedclothes, and yet it forces a smile across his scarred and weathered face.
"Call for help," he growls.
That's all he really wants from this, to spread the word, to summon armies worth taking on. Instead, she fires at him again. She's still got the gun in her hand, and it stings him under his gorget. He barks a laugh and hurls her to one side, cracking her bloodily into a bulkhead. He wades into the rest of the herd then, lashing out lazily. The volume of screaming is beginning to make his ears tingle.
"Putrefier!"
he voxes as he works, wondering if Slurt's already engaged.
"Anything worth killing yet?"
"There's a garrison, gallowsman,"
comes Slurt's eager voice.
"Superb,"
says Dragan, advancing on the last of those still standing.
"Leave some for me. I don't think I'll be kept here much longer."
But Slurt has his hands full. The Lords of Silence are spread out across the jumble of outbuildings and corrugated habs, and he is among the first to locate the only genuine prospect of resistance. It is a hazed, muted prospect in the night's driving wind, blurred by the gale of particles that race across this barren landscape. Slurt knows what kind of world this is. He takes indecent pleasure in the knowledge that the Imperials consider it a fertile place, one from which sustenance can be taken. For him, schooled and steeped in the deepest concoctive formulations of the god, they might as well have paved it over with rockcrete and doused the rest in acid. It is a dead world. It is empty, barren, and hideous. Nothing should linger here. Nothing should be suffered to remain. For all that, there are opportunities. There will be silos somewhere, and vast expanses of just about growing matter. Perhaps there might be a few novel strings of molecules lurking amid all that conformity, something he can wrangle out and distill and spin around. That is, after all, his chief motivation, and the way in which he gives glory to the god. He is Biologos, master of petri dishes and cultures, the refiner of phages and exciting disturbances. It will have to wait, though. For the moment, the Imperials, credit to them, are putting up something of a fight. The garrison compound is walled, with defense towers at the corners and guns mounted atop the roof-level platforms within. There are 2 sets of gates, one on either side, and he approaches the first of them now. There are shooters on the ramparts, protected by a heavy parapet, though they are struggling to pick their targets in the flying storm wind. Others of his brotherhood are closing in on the compound now, striding out of the howling dark. He can see the outlines of one of Garstag's juggernauts, even more cumbersome than the rest of the warband's unbroken, shrugging off a hail of direct impacts. There are dim green glows on the far side,
indicating more of his brothers stalking into range. Slurt has one capability none of the rest enjoy. His mortal eyes wasted away a long time ago, gnawed into pulp by parasites and left to dribble out of their sockets. But he has many more replacements across his whole body, bulbous nodules wedged under the skin that swivel and peer and blink. For Slurt, the entire battlefield is a shifting tapestry of false colour imagery, a ghostly overlaid shimmer of infection. He does perceive the real, but only as if glimpsed through a dirty, blotchy glass. What he really spies is the infected, the signs of corruption and failure and closeted spawnings. Much of the time this means decay within inanimate objects. He can isolate metal rot and fungal spread and damp and rockcrete cancer, but that is not the purpose of his gift. His true talent is for the living, for the hot, blood-pumping carriers of bacteria and viruses that cluster around him. That is what he sees now, straight through the translucent skein of the garrison wall units. Like corpuscles in a bloodstream, he sees troopers jog down tunnels or crouch behind strongpoints. He knows where they are by their life spore, a signature in the living warp that only his glorious mutations perceive. And that gives him certain advantages. He knows where the weak links are and how to exploit them. As the others close in, drawing fire dutifully, he limps up to the walls, extends his gauntlets, and clamps them onto a thin joint between panels. The first touch brings the metal exploding out in rivers of corrosion, oxidization spreading like wildfire, shooting up and out from his grip. Slurt smiles and exerts more pressure. The entire section seems to age instantly, rotting from within, and soon it is collapsing in his grip, falling away, exposing a lumen-lit void beyond. The defenders see what he is doing and rush to drive him back, but by then it is already too late. Slurt is clambering through the breach, a nightmare bursting out of the whirling dust. He draws his injector pistol, and every shot finds its target. Guardsmen collapse as soon as they are hit, doubling over and vomiting their own windpipes out. Slurt shoves and barges his way deeper in, cutting down those who get too close with his serrated cleaver blade, dropping those who remain at range with his pistol. By now, his unbroken brothers have made their own incursions, blasting through the walls or tearing them apart with power fists. They are in their element now, gliding like vengeful cadavers through the wreckage, slaying in their deliberate, stolid manner. A guardsman rushes him, screaming something about his emperor protecting this and that. Slurt sees him for what he is, mid-thirties, already cradling a few nondescript ailments within his undernourished body, including the liver cancer that would kill him in a few years anyway, and shoots him through the chest. The man goes down like a lead ingot, writhing, clutching at his neck with stiffening fingers. An injector needle gives a far more vivid experience than cancer, one that will fry his nerve ends and make his synapses sing. Not that you'll ever get thanks for gifts like that. Slurt smashes his way through the teetering doors at the end of the corridor, breaking back out into the open, an inner courtyard, and sees the entire place thrown into disorder. Flames have started up, all of them ripe with a stink of unnatural chems, and the fires are now racing out of control. Unbroken warriors are rampaging through the defences in all directions, upending barricades and hacking down those still brave enough to man them. The soldiers are in full retreat now, herring back across towards the north wall, covered by lasfire from their comrades on the far parapets. They're sprinting, those who still can. Slurt hears a throaty cough, like a groxherd entering heat, and turns to see a big crawler unit, 5 meters high on huge tires and thickly shielded against the wind, gun its engines. It's only meters away from him, and he reaches out to shoot at it. It swerves, squealing on rubber, and his shot grazes the near side shielding. It's being driven erratically, far too fast for its unwieldy bulk, and it nearly topples over. Slurt laughs out loud and shoots it again. This time he hits, and the crawler skids across the dust. Its armor just about holds, and whoever's driving it manages to spin it straight towards the opposite gates. These are closed still, but burning furiously and clearly weakened. The crawler roars towards them, bumps over a corpse, smashes clean into the barrier, bucks over the tumbling metal, and then gets out.
Well done,
Slurt murmurs, wondering if the drivers have any idea what he shot them with. A pity. They were resourceful. Then he turns back to the slaughter. All around him, he sees bodies, transparent sacks of contagion, wobbling and bursting and racing away from him.
Now then, that's a specimen,
he says, picking the next target and lowering the injector.
Shit,
says Bhattacharya. Makkad drives.
Shit, shit, shit!
Makkad keeps his hands on the wheel, gripping tight.
What in the hell were... What in the hell, Olaf?
She's shaking hard. She's already been sick. That happened when they were first sighted from the walls. But she wants to be sick again. The shakes are getting worse. It is a bumpy ride. A crawler, as the name suggests, is designed to go sedately, rocking across the uneven plains of the resource. Now Makkad is driving it very fast, throwing both of them around in the cab.
Shit, 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 shit!
Makkad has his foot locked to the accelerator piston. The world outside is a hurricane of blown chaff peppering the forward visor. The last of the light has fallen behind them. Ahead, there is nothing but the night storm. Bhattacharya grabs her helm and wrenches it off. She's hyperventilating and needs to calm herself. She can't get the images out of her head, though. She doesn't even have a word for what they were. Monsters, terror shapes, goblins, bogeymen. The smell of them is still in the cab. It's indescribable. A mix of rotting meat, Medicaid fluids, and feces. But that doesn't convey the extent to which it makes you want to retch, to loose your bowels, to pluck your own eyeballs out and crush them between your own shivering fingers. She can't look back. Surely they're all dead by now anyway, the others. It was so terrifyingly quick, so completely one-sided. They couldn't be hurt. She'd seen lasbeam after lasbeam strike home, and they hadn't so much as stumbled. They just walked through it. Bhattacharya tries to stop her mind racing. Dantin might still be fighting. She'd seen him rally his troops and retreat back to the armory, somehow keeping it together in the face of those creatures. She couldn't have stayed. There was nothing she could have done. The priority now was to get to the first node, to overload the weather stations. Once they went down, the entire biosphere would start to degrade, denying them Najan's only asset, its immense productive capacity. It's something to hang on to. The closest one is only a few kilometers away, far from the complex boundaries, and you can set a chain reaction off from any of them. It's a last failsafe, designed just for this eventuality by ever-vigilant Mechanicus adepts. She rubs her eyes. She blinks hard.
Slow down, Olaf,
she says, trying to get a grip on where they are. His foot stays where it is. She can see his neck muscles under his helm, and they're protruding alarmingly.
Olaf, slow down! We're out! Come on, job to do!
Gradually, he relaxes a bit. He starts to steer properly. The crawler stops jumping everywhere, and the axles stop shrieking.
You have the coordinates?
She asks, fumbling with her forearm implant to get the access codes. Makkad is still struggling to talk.
Yeah,
he manages to get out at last. They're still going too fast, but that's the least of her worries. She's in a cold sweat and can't find the numbers.
It's coming up,
she warns. The storm's getting worse, a hail of particle-stuffed wind that slams up against them. It's near pitch black ahead. They should see it soon, a needle-shaped pylon 40 meters high, blinking with markers. Something thumps on the cab's roof, and she jumps.
What was that?
She asks.
Can't see it yet,
Makkad grunts. Bhattacharya peers into the flying murk.
It must be...
The rear glass pane shatters, and she screams. Something fist-sized tumbles into the cab and latches onto Makkad. He tries to swat it off, and the crawler lurches. Bhattacharya reaches out, grabs it. It's wet and scaly, and rips it from his jacket. The thing wriggles in her grip, twists, then turns on her. A wide grin splits its tiny body, yellow eyes light up, and it goes for her throat.
She screams again, struggling to slap it off. It's whip-quick and horribly strong, like a bag of snakes, and its teeth snap at her face and spray her with spittle. Somehow she manages to elbow the window catch loose and flings the thing at the pane. It splats hard against the glass, then tumbles out of the gap. She hears a long wail as it flies into the night.
"What was..."
she starts, then sees Makard. He's going limp, his hand slipping from the wheel. A bloody wheel glistens at his neck.
"I can't see,"
he slurs.
"Olaf!"
she yells, grabbing the wheel before he loses control completely. The cab fills with flying chaff. Another thump on the roof. Then another. Bhattacharya sees something flop into the cab, wobble towards them. She recoils and feels something wet below. She looks down, and there's one squatting in the footwell, hissing at her.
"Shit!"
she screams, stamping on it furiously. More of them tumble inside, squirming up the cab frame, swinging from tiny arms through the broken windows. She only catches glimpses of them in the confusion. Marsh-green bodies, scabs and warts, spiked fingers, and those horrific, far too wide mouths. Something slimy latches onto her jacket, and she screams again. She has a brief image of Makard, his face lost under a pulsing sack of flesh. Then there's a puff of blood, splattering against the windscreen, and the crawler keels over. The world tilts off its axis. Her stomach lurches, and she's briefly weightless. Then the whole structure crashes onto its side. The crawler skids, engines whining at full tilt. Two wheels churning up the earth as they keep spinning. She's thrown around, yanked against her restraints, until the crawler hits something hard and jerks to a halt, nearly upended. The creatures are thrown off her by the impact, burst open as they hit the glass splinters. She's dazed for a second, blood running down her forehead, but panicked adrenaline is still flooding through her. She unclips her restraint, fingers shaking, and shoves her way out of the splintered hole where the rear windshield used to be. She can't see any more of the creatures, but doesn't linger to check. Somehow, the access codes are still blinking on her implant. Ahead of her, less than 100 meters off, she sees the transmitter through the wind, a dark island of stability. She starts to run. Her leg spikes with pain, and something's badly wrong with her ribs, but she's got to get there. Barley fronds hiss around her as she limps towards the node's wire fencing. The wind howls, and she thinks she can hear something like giggling.
"Oh, holy throne,"
she murmurs, staggering faster, heart hammering. There's only one thought in her mind now.
Get to the node, shut down the weather net, deny the enemy the resource.
She gets to the gate. She fumbles the lock, gets it open, pushes the frame back. The node rises up into the night, its on-off marker beacon almost obliterated by the chaff wind. She stumbles, light-headed now, gets to her feet again. The entrance to the command station is just up ahead, a blast door set into an adamantium frame, capable of withstanding a direct hit from a howitzer. She slumps up against it, mercifully cut out of the wind. She's shuddering badly now, feeling the blood loss, but manages to slot the intake needle into her arm. There's a click, a whir, and the blast door lock slides back. A bar of yellow light slides over the ground at her feet as the panels part. A surge of euphoria swelling up within her, she feels the warmth of the interior on her face and stumbles to get inside. It is absolutely impossible that they should be waiting for her. There is no way in, no gap, no chance of gnawing through that blast shielding. It is a secure chamber designed to a standard Imperial template, and utterly impregnable. For a moment, her brain refuses to believe the evidence of her senses, and she keeps moving towards the gap. The little lords are happy to greet her, spilling off their perches inside the command station, thumping to the ground to waddle up to her with their arms spread. They swarm at her, racing up her legs like ship rats and sinking their teeth in deep. Her screams are brief this time, choked off by the mass of minuscule bodies overwhelming her. For a moment, she struggles under the squirming mass, one arm extended, before they engulf her entirely, chewing and spitting
and gnawing. It is all over very quickly. The frenzy passes. The little lords, soon sated, grow bored and start to wander off. One of them, its belly glistening and its teeth still dripping, waddles out of the open doorway. It looks at the smoking remains of the crawler on its side in a furrow of driven earth. It looks at the crops swaying wildly in the driving wind. It looks at the night sky, still subject to full weather control. It does not understand the significance of any of this. It has done what it always does, followed its hungry instincts. It is absurdly happy. Almost all of the time, it is absurdly happy. Then it swivels around, pivoting on a miniature slop of obesity, to see its fellows start to gorge again. It belches, picks its nose, then scampers back to join them. Dantine can see they are breaking through. There is nothing in his arsenal powerful enough to even slow them, let alone halt them. At one point, he thought they had actually downed one, a concentrated lasburst from 20 men, all aimed at the same target. The monster had stumbled, tottering over heavily as the combined hits took their toll. Dantine dared to believe for a moment that they had at last nailed one of the bastards. But then it got back up. It hauled itself to its feet, armor plate glowing from the kinetic energy discharged, its horrific eyes still shining, its claws reaching for the trigger on that bestial-looking firearm. It strode back into the Lazstorm and started killing again. And that had crushed them. Dantine and his senior command group fell back to the central building, pulling in every survivor they could, barricaded it, and prepared to die there. Even from within the walls, he could tell that the wind was still blowing outside. Bhattacharya's plan to reach the nodes in time had always been a forlorn hope. This world would fall, intact, to the enemy. Now he waits for them grimly, knowing that his charge pack is almost spent. They all crouch behind upended tables at the far end of the long corridor, fewer than 30 now, their weapons readied. They hear the crunch and slam of walls breaking, and the agonized yowls of other soldiers being killed in that terrible, unhurried way. He presses his finger over the trigger, mouthing prayers. He has seen action many times before. He has faced greenskins on far-off worlds, back when he aspired to achieve something with the Astra Militarum. He has faced heretic cultists in the depths of stinking hive towers, and thought at the time that no man could witness horror greater than that.
"Holy throne of earth,"
he whispers softly, the first words of an old ministorum hymn, a child's catechism. Startled, he realizes the men around him are taking up the soft chant. They begin to sing, hardly audibly, their guns still held fast.
"In faith we are preserved."
The first of the monsters comes around the corner, and the las guns open up, flash after flash. This creature is as foul as the rest of them, a colossal beast in stinking, slithering armor, grotesquely huge and surrounded by clouds of insects. It carries a scythe that crackles with a pale energy.
"Across the whole of space."
Dantine sings with the rest, though he can hardly squeeze the words out of his fear-choked throat. Every shot is hitting it, and none of it makes any difference. The thing walks towards them, taking its time. Some of the defenders begin to retch.
"No shameful thought, no unclean deed."
He fires, and fires, and fires. The monster reaches the barricade of tables and gets to work, lifting them away and crushing those cowering on the far side. It pulls apart human bodies as if they were made of damp paper. A trooper, in desperation, draws a knife and launches himself at it. He is swatted off and crushed underfoot, the knife left trembling where he plunged it, hilt deep into rotten armor hide.
"Obscures the glory of our race."
The thing gets closer to Dantine, and he sees that there are tiny numbers on its armor, picked out in black ink. They look handwritten, scrawled in some obsessive frenzy over every inch of exposed armor. It wheezes as it comes for him,
and he sees flecks of blood and vomit on the fractured breastplate. It has an air of incredible age to it, a spectre of a lost epoch, unearthed at the dawn of time, and given flesh to torment the living galaxy. Dantine's charge pack gives out, and he switches grip, angling the bayonet. The monster has seen him, and he springs, going for the creature's neck. He puts every last ounce of strength into the leap, holding the weapon two-handed above his head, shouting out as he hurtles towards the objective. The monster catches him in mid-leap. Claws snap across his chest, holding him rigid. His weapon spins away uselessly, and Dantine finds himself staring straight into the creature's face. The mask is huge, well beyond anything human. He can see tubes snaking under the cracked rim, throbbing with dark liquids. He can see flies crawling all over it, and glossy sores on the tarnished ceramite. He can see a pair of lenses backlit with eerie green light, as thick as cream. He can see numbers written all over the ridges of barnacled armour, vanishing into impossibly small characters. Dantine spits in its face. The spittle curdles as it hits, turning lumpy like old cheese. He hears a rumble from within the carcass of the monster and realizes it's a deep, corrosive laugh. There's nothing human about that laugh. The voice is too ruined, too overlaid with corruption and distortion and slow malice.
"Kill me, then!"
Dantine dares it, raging now, more angry at the blasphemy than afraid. The monster looks at him for a while. All Dantine can see is its dark lenses, unblinking and unknowable. Then it shakes its head.
"Not you," it slurs.
It squeezes gently, and Dantine can feel himself passing out.
"No!"
he gasps, enraged, flailing against the grip, kicking out against the unyielding wall of stinking, mouldering armour. But the fight is lost. As awareness fades, he realizes the worst thing of all, that he's not going to die here, that he will be denied even a noble end, and that for him, this is all just beginning. Chapter 8. The sun comes up. Garstag walks out to the far edge of the complex in order to observe it. It is a little rite for him, a small habit that he sees no reason to extinguish. After every successful action, he makes sure to see the sun come up on the worlds he has conquered. He has seen many suns rise, blazing blue-white orbs that sent shadows leaping across the rocks, mid-range yellow stars that must be reminiscent of terror for those who remember it, and ones like this one, old and tired and amber, filling a sixteenth of the sky with a weary light. The complex is still burning. Slurt discovered promethium tanks and set them off. After that, he drove a few survivors into the inferno, where they were caught between death at his hands and death in the flames. It was a poor game, that, one that the Cardane Master disapproved of. They deserved a chance to die on their feet. He walks out further, getting away from the acrid smell of charred flesh and metal. The skies are dusty, still blown by an incessant boom of wind. In the distance, he can see towers, studding the landscape at regular intervals. Between them is nothing, just a wasteland of rustling corn. He keeps walking. He passes a huge vehicle, its innards twisted and its internal machinery ripped out. Hoppers, each one capable of storing hundreds of tons of material, have been pulled apart, and the dust and grain are mingling into a dry slurry underfoot. He hears something out in the wastes, and walks away from the abandoned vehicle. He sees Clado kneeling out in the middle of one of the hyperfields, and lumbers over to join him. The surgeon doesn't appear to notice him coming, or perhaps is merely too engrossed in his work. Garstag sees what he has been up to. The severed bodies of Imperial servitors are lying in the dirt all around him, dozens of them. Some are clearly missing body parts. about 50 are waiting meekly for his attention, standing in the field with their eyes focusing well into the distance. They're big creatures, bred for muscle, with absurdly small heads perched atop all that vat-grown bulk. Clado looks up. He has a needle in one hand, thread in another.
What?
He snaps. Garstag does not ask what he is doing. The Brotherhood of Surgeons is notoriously secretive. If he had to guess, it would be that there is no clear purpose here, and that Clado is simply bored. Perhaps he wishes to test the pain tolerances of these things, or merely see if they can be recombined in some novel way.
Not much of a theatre,
Garstag says. Clado stops what he is doing and looks around. The wind-blown crops whisper back at him.
Where was their support?
He asks. Garstag nods.
It's a big world. There's a lot of fodder here.
There should have been a response. Even if the planet itself did not maintain an adequate garrison, there should have been an alert network within the system, primed to respond. That was how the Imperium operated. It could not guard every single hunk of rock that it laid claim to, but it could act quickly when the alarm was raised. Garstag has seen this many times. A target would be hit, and within hours there would be landers darkening the skies. It was what they had all hoped for, a cascade of steadily increasing resistance, something to get their claws into. Clado puts his bloody materials down and gets up.
It's like they've given up,
he says. Garstag snorts.
You saw what it was like at the gate. I don't think they've given up. Maybe we have, though.
Clado looks intrigued.
What do you mean?
Garstag almost doesn't tell him. It is hard to know when the time is right.
Don't tell me you would have chosen this target, he says carefully.
No one chose it. It's where we ended up.
Yes. Strange, that.
Clado suddenly looks angry. His moods are like a child's, quick and complete, swinging from one extreme to the other.
There's been plenty of talk. Don't add me to it, or I'll be stitching you to something foul.
Garstag laughs.
Nah, we shouldn't be anywhere near here. We should have followed the despoiler out of Cadia.
He sighs, feeling his muscles ache for more action.
You and I both know it, surgeon. He's lost his way.
Who?
Asks Clado, looking shrewd. It is a big thing to name the Primarch. They do not openly criticize him, for they know that words, even whispered ones, have a way of carrying back to the plague planet. For some in the Legion, Mortarion is little less than a god, a slayer sage elevated into the skirts of immortality. Even for those who think otherwise, he is still the most powerful of them all, a creature capable of turning the universe inside out in the cause of vengeance. Since his return to speech and activity, it has become perilous even to voice doubt, to utter a word of concern. In any case, that is not who he meant.
Tell me, surgeon,
Garstag says,
who gives a damn for Ultramar? I do not. I do not care whether it prospers or rots. How about you?
Clado thinks for a moment, then slowly nods.
We do not set the course.
So, what do you want from this? I never asked you.
Clado laughs.
A better world. More subjects for my predilections.
Liar!
Garstag stalks moodily away.
He's led us for a long time. I find the obsessions wearying. It can't go on, brother.
Then do something.
You recommend it?
Clado shrugs.
Don't come here fishing for support. Do something or hold your claws closed. That's the way of things.
I find it interesting to gauge views, that is all.
Clado snorts and gets back to his work. The needle flickers, snicker-snack, and surgical thread weaves.
I'll say this for the siege master. He was there, like I was. We both reached out, saw the walls, and for a moment they were falling, falling. It was so, so close. And he's never stopped fighting. I did, for a long time. It's not easy to keep the hatred alive, sometimes, especially in the eye, where there are diversions.
We're not in the eye, though, are we?
Neither are we where we were supposed to be.
And you know nothing about how that happened.
Do you?
They look at one another for a moment, a slight push of strength against strength. Eventually, Garstag looks away.
You're making a mess of those things.
I'm making them better. That's our creed, brother. You should learn some religion.
Garstag's lips curl into something approaching disgust. Even now, even after he has seen and done so much, Clado's preferences can prove endlessly dismaying.
Think on it, he says, turning back towards the ruins of the complex.
The smoke from the last of the fires gusts about them, blown at a low level into the fields. But Clado is no longer listening. He beckons to another servitor, waiting mutely in line.
Next,
he says, brandishing the bloody needle. Dantin takes a long time to wake up. He is half aware of dreams in that time. He dreams of being taken up by men with no faces and carried somewhere far away. He sees stars swinging overhead, hundreds of them. At one point, he thinks he wakes, and he feels the shake of an orbital lander, and then the nausea of a rapid ascent. Then he is out again. He dreams of Bhattacharya, and somehow knows she is dead. He liked her, and believes she liked him. They might have achieved something together, had they not been stranded on such a nondescript world, and haunted by mutually incomprehensible pasts. He wonders why she was posted there. He wonders why he was never brave enough to ask her. Then he dreams that something is cutting him. He feels something being excised, dragged out of him. He hears voices, terrible voices, speaking through sputum in a language he does not understand. Then he stops dreaming. Much later, very much later, consciousness returns. He blinks, and a shifting world comes back into something like focus. He feels horribly ill, more than normal for a void transit. He is lying on his back, and he twists over to be sick. He sees the vomiter slap on the floor, thick and greasy, and the smell appalls him. Then he lies on his back again, panting. He is clammy and cold, and he shuts his eyes. His chest hurts. He does not want to be alive. That thought prompts him to force himself awake properly. Perhaps there is something he can do about that. Spite the enemy before the advent of whatever questioning or torment they have in mind. He blinks again, hard, clearing room from his eyes. He tries to get a sense of where he is and what has happened. He is inside a cell, metal-lined, metal-floored. It stinks. Some of that stink is from him. His uniform is soiled, and his various excreta reek. Foul matter is caked on every surface. The metal is heavily oxidized, stained, and calcified. The floor is wet, and little bubbles pop to the surface of oily puddles. He is on a long bench, also metal, also rusting away to nothing. The lone lumen is a chain-suspended sodium lamp, as dirty as everything else. There are furry things with many eyes crawling up the walls. Dantin wipes his mouth and tries to sit up. His rib cage is the worst. He must have been hit hard there. His knife is gone, of course, as is anything else sharp. Aside from the smell, there is a taste in the air, a chemical taste, like something fermenting. He hears noises all around him, just as one always does on a starship. Noise resounds within a vessel in space from the total enclosure, running on top of the endemic growl of engines, air cyclers, water cyclers, shield generators, and the rest. But this one is different to any starship he has been on before. He can detect horrible noises just below the grind of the machinery. Some are moans, some are repeating cries, some are unidentifiable. Dantin is not a cowardly man, but those noises make him shiver. He looks up. The cell's solitary door is opening. Weak as he feels, he clenches his fists and prepares to move. Metal shrieks as the heavy door is shoved inward. Dantin leaps, seeing something huge and blurry in the gap, and going for it. He falls short, nearly passing out the instant he moves, and collapses into his own refuse. On his knees, he feels like weeping. He can barely lift a fist, let alone do his duty and attack his tormentor. He does not resist as huge hands reach for him, lift him up, place him back on the slab. Then he is looking up into the same eyes as before, at the number-scrawled plates, at the bizarrely pocked and bloated armor.
"Do not try that again," the monster says.
The voice is just as it was on Najan, like a throat submerged in oil, cracking and engine-harsh. The language is also strange and hard to follow, though patently some form of Gothic.
"Why don't you kill me?" Dantin croaks.
The monster gives him a canister of water. He takes it and drinks greedily.
"I am named Vaux, siege master of the 14th Legion, called the Death Guard. You are on the ship, Solace, in the care of the Lords of Silence. What is your name?"
Once a thing has a name, you can no longer call him it. He becomes a person, albeit of the most warped and esoteric kind. Even in the midst of his nausea and weakness, Dantin cannot escape a sliver of awe that creeps in. This warrior is old beyond imagination. That is evident just from the way he looks, moves, and speaks. He even smells old. One of the melange of aromas this creature gives off is the kind of decay only the truly decrepit exude. There had always been rumors, never spoken of except in the most intimate company, of space marines who had turned, who had given themselves over to the ruinous powers. Most sensible people discounted the notion. A space marine could not turn. But still, the gossip never went away. Dantin remembered serving with a lieutenant who swore that he'd heard a definite account of this happening, with campaign names and dates. 2 weeks later, that lieutenant was summoned to a meeting with the commissariat, and never returned. For most, that was proof he must have been spouting heretical rubbish. For a few thoughtful souls, though, it was enough to give them pause.
"Captain Gaval Dantin, Najan Station Resident Defense Force," he says.
"I do not think you began your career on Najan," says Vaux. "You fought like a man who knows how to use a weapon. Is this right?"
He doesn't want to reply. He wants to remain defiant, to list his name and position again until they tire of it, and either kill him or bring in instruments of torment. Perhaps it is the eyes that do it. Looking into those deep lenses, swimming with what looks like some kind of marsh gas, drains his resolve. Or perhaps it is the crushing stink, his physical weakness, the knowledge that everyone who had served with him on that world is now dead.
"I served in the Astra Militarum for 15 years.
15 years.
The creature, Vaux, shifts so that he is standing a little further off. His movements are almost awkward, as if the bones within that colossal hulk have been warped or rearranged. Things gurgle as he shuffles, or they drip, or they weep lines of glistening liquid.
"That is a long time to stay alive in service. You must have been a good soldier, Captain Dantin."
"Not really."
"What brought you to Najan?"
He does not wish to answer this. The creature senses it and, surprisingly, lets it drop.
No matter. Every man must have his secrets.
Vorks reaches up to brush a strand of something viscous.